Welcome to the Deep Dive. If you're a nursing student, maybe getting ready for that first big medical surgical rotation, or maybe you've just been told to brush up on, well, the biggest infectious killer in the U.S., you're definitely in the right place today. We're doing a really critical deep dive into pneumonia. And look, we're not just going to skim definitions. We're framing this as knowledge you need now, stuff for the clinical setting. Pneumonia, it's everywhere in healthcare, every unit, every setting. And unfortunately, it's still, along with flu, a leading infectious cause of death here. So understanding it, how it works, the subtle signs, and yeah, crucially, how you can help prevent it, it's probably one of the most vital skills you can get down early.
That's spot on, yeah. Our goal today really is to take all this info, lecture notes, clinical guidelines, and boil it down, synthesize it. But specifically through the lens of what you do as a nurse, actionable stuff, we want to focus on those high-yield interventions, you know? The daily checks, the prevention bundles, like the VAP protocols, things you'll actually be doing that make a huge difference. Life or death difference, sometimes.
Yeah, exactly. And we're pulling from solid sources for this detailed lecture outlines, good pathophysiology guides, diagnostic pathways, and those really meticulous prevention protocols.
Think of this deep dive as your clinical cheat sheet almost. We want to give you not just the facts, but that clinical awareness, that ability to spot the difference, sometimes a really subtle difference between a standard community bug and maybe a really nasty hospital-acquired superbug, and understanding why that difference means you have to act fast, act aggressively.
Okay, let's dive in. Section one, defining the disease, the pathology underneath it all. So let's start right at the bottom. We hear pneumonia all the time. What's actually happening at like the cellular level?
Okay, simplest terms. Pneumonia is acute inflammation. Inflammation of the lung tissue itself. And when we say lung tissue, we mean the parenchyma, right? The functional bits. And it's caused by invaders, microorganisms, mostly bacteria, but viruses, fungi, mycobacteria too. They're all common culprits. And we also need to think about chemical irritation or mechanical stuff like inhaling foreign substances. That can pave the way for infection too.
Okay, that distinction, it brings up something that trips students up sometimes. Pneumonia versus pneumonitis. They sound almost the same.
They do, and it's a really vital clinical point. Good one to clarify. Pneumonia means there's an infection. A microorganism is actively causing harm. That's key. Pneumonitis.
Okay.
Well, that's broader. It's just general lung inflammation. Think about, say, aspirating stomach acid. That causes a chemical burn, right? That initial burn is pneumonitis, pure inflammation. But that intense inflammation, it hammers the lung's defenses, which then makes the patient incredibly vulnerable to getting pneumonia, the actual infection, maybe right after. So knowing the difference guides treatment, you see. Antibiotics for pneumonia, for pneumonitis, often just supportive care unless we confirm an infection's taken hold.
Right. And thinking about clinical impact, let's go back to how serious this is. You said leading infectious cause of death.
Yeah, and that fact really drives the urgency, doesn't it? Even with all our modern medicine, you know, great antibiotics, fancy ventilators, pneumonia, along with flu, is still a major infectious killer in the U.S. It's not just a bad cough. It's a fundamental failure of the body's defenses. So when we talk patient safety, preventing pneumonia has got to be right near the top of the list.
Okay, let's get into the mechanics, the pathophysiology. Once that bug gets in, how does the inflammation cause the symptoms we actually see? You know, the trouble breathing, the low oxygen.
Right. It's like a domino effect starting in the alveoli, the tiny air sacs. When the pathogen gets down there, the immune system kicks in, launches this big inflammatory defense. But that defense involves flooding the area with white blood cells, fluid. We call it exudate formation. So basically the alveoli, which should be full of air, they start filling up with gunk fluid, inflammatory cells, pus.
So instead of air getting in, the space is clogged with this inflammatory soup.
Exactly. And that's the disaster physiologically. That fluid barrier stops oxygen from easily getting across that really delicate membrane between the alveoli and the capillaries. It can't diffuse into the blood properly. And that failure is what we call a VQ mismatch.
Okay, VQ mismatch. Explain that one. It sounds complicated, but feels like something really core to respiratory care.
It is core. Think of VQ as just a ratio. Ventilation, the V, that's the air getting to the alveoli. Perfusion, the Q, that's the blood flow around those alveoli. Ideally, V and Q match up pretty well, like 1-to-1. But with pneumonia, when the alveoli are full of fluid, blood's still flowing past, good perfusion Q, but there's no fresh oxygen-rich air getting into that specific sac. terrible ventilation V. So the VQ ratio tanks, it plummets. We call that shunting. Blood goes through the lungs but doesn't pick up oxygen. And that leads straight to hypoxemia, low oxygen in the blood, which then triggers those symptoms we see, like tachypnea, the fast breathing, as the body tries desperately to compensate to get more V.
Okay. That makes total sense then. The patient's breathing fast because their body knows the air they are moving isn't actually doing its job efficiently?
Precisely. They're trying to increase the volume of air going in just to make up for the fact that a lot of it is going to these fluid-filled, non-working areas. Wasted effort.
Gotcha. And one more thing from the sources on structure. They talked about different patterns of infection in the lungs. Lobar versus bronchopneumonia.
Right. That's about how it looks, the morphology. Mm-hmm. Where the infection is concentrated. Lobar pneumonia, that's usually pretty dramatic looking. It hits one or more whole lobes of the lung solidly. So the inflammation, the consolidation, it's all connected, like a solid block on the x-ray, often caused by really potent bugs like strep pneumo. Bronchop pneumonia, though, that's actually what you'll probably see more often clinically, especially with hospital-acquired stuff. It's more patchy, diffuse. It tends to start in the bronchi, those larger airways, and then spreads out into lots of smaller lung areas. Because it's scattered like that, it often affects both lungs, you know, bilaterally and multiple spots at once. Clinically, that can sometimes make it a bit harder to spot on an early x-ray if it's subtle. And it might be a slower onset illness sometimes, but it can be much more widespread, which adds to the overall burden on the patient.
Okay, that pattern difference leads us right into classification. And this feels like maybe the most crucial first step for a nurse assessing a patient. Because like you said, not all pneumonias are the same. And knowing where the patient got it tells you a lot about the likely bug, how resistant it might be, and what treatment needs to happen right now.
Absolutely. Classifying by where it was acquired. Non-negotiable knowledge.
Right.
Seriously. Get the classification wrong, and you might be using a standard antibiotic for a super-resistant hospital bug. That treatment will fail. The patient could go downhill fast.
Okay, let's start where most patients start. Community-acquired pneumonia. CAP.
Right. CAP, defined as pneumonia you get outside of any healthcare setting or that shows up within the first 48 hours after you get admitted. Basically, the source isn't the hospital, it's the community, your recent environment. And most of these cases, they're caused by pretty common bugs that are usually susceptible to standard antibiotics. The number one culprit, students, you got to memorize this one, Streptococcus pneumonia. Or strep pneumo. Others you see a lot are Haemophilus influenza, H flu, Mycoplasma pneumonia, that's the one people sometimes call walking pneumonia, and definitely increasingly different respiratory viruses. Treatment for CAP is usually pretty standard, starting with empiric antibiotics that cover these likely suspects.
Okay, now let's shift gears into the hospital, the healthcare world. Much trickier, often much deadlier. The sources mention a sort of intermediate category first. Healthcare-associated pneumonia, or HCAP.
Yeah, HCAP. This classification has kind of evolved a bit, but the core idea is still really important. These are patients who aren't in the hospital right now, but they've had a lot of recent contact with the healthcare system. So think patients recently discharged, maybe folks in nursing homes or long-term care, or people getting regular outpatient stuff like chemo or dialysis.
And why are they automatically higher risk than just a standard CAP patient?
Well, because of all that contact, right? They might have picked up or been colonized with bugs that usually hang out in hospitals, organisms that have already seen a lot of antibiotics and have developed resistance. So when you're treating HCAP, you have to think, potential for drug resistance here is higher than CAP. The treatment approach often starts leaning more towards the HAT guidelines. And the source material rightly points out that HCAP often includes aspiration events and cases in immunocompromised people.
Okay, that perfectly sets up the most dangerous category then.
Yeah.
Hospital-acquired pneumonia, HAP.
Right. HAP, defined strictly by time. It's pneumonia that develops 48 hours or more after someone's admitted to the hospital. Why the 48 hours? Well, it usually takes about that long for hospital bugs to take root and cause an infection. And HAP, much higher mortality rate. Why? Because the patients are already sick, obviously, and the bugs involved are often way more aggressive and way more resistant to antibiotics.
And the ICU version of that, ventilator-associated pneumonia. VAP.
VAP, yep, subset of HAP. Specifically, it develops 48 hours or more after someone's been intubated, put on a ventilator. For you, as a nursing student, VAP should scream major problem because it often represents a failure in prevention. That breathing tube, the endotracheal tube, it's basically a highway for bacteria straight into the lungs, bypasses all the natural defenses in the nose and throat. VAP rates are a huge quality measure for hospitals, preventing it. That's one of the most critical measurable things an ICU nurse does.
Okay, so let's connect this directly to nursing relevance, identifying those high-risk patients and knowing why these hospital bugs are so much nastier.
They're nastier because they're survivors, basically. The hospital environment is like a constant battleground, selecting for the toughest, most resistant bacteria. So when HAP or VAP happens, we're often fighting nasty gram-negative rods like Enterobacter, E. coli, Klebsiella, and the really feared one, Pseudomonas aeruginosa. It's infamous for forming biofilms like protective shields, and it's naturally resistant to a ton of drugs. Plus, we're always worried about resistant gram-positives, too, especially MRSA methicillin-resistant Staph aureus. Requires totally different, often more toxic antibiotics. So knowing those risk factors, being over 65, having chronic heart or lung issues, alcoholism, being immunosuppressed, and especially having had antibiotics recently that lets you, as the nurse, immediately flag that patient for extra vigilance, implement stricter infection control, ramp up prevention right from the moment they arrive.
Let's dig into those specialized types that need immediate, very specific nursing actions. First up, aspiration pneumonia.
Right. This is pneumonia caused by breathing foreign stuff into the lungs. Stomach contents, saliva, food, liquids, anything that shouldn't be there. The chemical irritation alone, like from stomach acid, causes that pneumonitis we talked about. And then the bacteria coming from the mouth or stomach quickly set up an infection.
So for nursing students, what's the immediate clinical connection for aspiration?
Risk is all about protective reflexes. You have to instantly link aspiration risk with patients who have dysphagia trouble swallowing. So who are they? Stroke patients, obviously. Mm-hmm. People with Parkinson's or other neuroconditions. Anyone heavily sedated. Patients who just had throat surgery or airway procedures. Clinically, if your patient has a wet, gurgly cough, especially during or after eating or drinking, or if their voice sounds wet or gurgly, that's a huge red flag. They might be actively aspirating.
So the intervention is purely assessment driven, right? Check first.
Absolutely. Assessment first, always. If you even suspect aspiration risk, you do the checks. No exceptions. Check for a good gag reflex. Can they follow commands? Are they getting the right food and liquid consistency, often thickened liquids? Are they positioned upright during and after meals? At least 30 degrees, ideally higher. Aspiration is so often preventable if you're just thorough with that initial assessment and ongoing monitoring.
Okay. And a last special type, opportunistic pneumonia.
This happens in patients whose immune systems are severely weakened. They just can't fight things off normally. So they get susceptible to organisms that a healthy person would clear easily, things that usually don't cause disease. Think HIV/AIDS patients, especially with low CD4 counts, people on high-dose chemo, transplant recipients on anti-rejection drugs, anyone on long-term high-dose steroids, they might get weird stuff like pneumocystis jirovecii pneumonia PCP or fungal pneumonias. The nursing takeaway here, strict infection control for them, protective isolation sometimes, and recognizing that even a mild cough or a low-grade fever in this population could be a sign of very serious infection. It's an emergency until proven otherwise.
All right, section 3. We know what it is, where it comes from. Now, the really hands-on part, spotting it. Clinical signs, assessment, diagnostics. And this is where it gets interesting, right? Because symptoms can look so different depending on the patient. Recognizing those variations is key.
Totally. The clinical picture is the puzzle we're putting together every shift. We usually think about it in three main ways. The classic presentation, a more gradual onset, and then the really tricky atypical presentation. The classic, sudden onset, that's the textbook case. Patient suddenly spikes a high fever, maybe with those really violent shaking chills, we call those rigors. They get sharp chest pain, pleuritic pain, meaning it hurts worse when they breathe deep or cough. They have a productive cough and they're breathing fast, tachypneic. The sputum, the stuff they cough up, is often purulent, thick, pus-like, or sometimes it has this characteristic rusty color. That rusty sputum often points towards strep pneumo.
But it's not always that dramatic, right? What about the slower, gradual start?
Right, the gradual onset. You see this more with bugs like mycoplasma or maybe some viruses. Instead of bam sick, the patient just feels generally lousy malaise, maybe for days, persistent headache, maybe a low-grade temp that isn't really spiking, some chest discomfort that creeps up slowly. They might just think, oh, it's a bad cold, you know, which can unfortunately delay them getting checked out.
But the sources really hammer home this point. You must know the atypical presentation in the elderly. Why is assessing older adults so challenging and dangerous here?
Because their immune response often just isn't typical. Their bodies change with age, their inflammatory signals get kind of blunted. So an older adult with really severe pneumonia might not have a high fever, they might not have a bad cough, they might not complain of that sharp pleuritic pain, just relying on the thermometer. It's dangerously misleading in this group.
Okay, so if those classic signs are missing, what are the red flags? What should you, as the nurse, be laser focused on instead?
The number one sign, acute change in mental status. That's the killer clue. Pneumonia in an older adult often shows up first as sudden confusion, new delirium, or just generalized lethargy, weakness that you can't explain otherwise. If your patient who was alert yesterday suddenly isn't making sense or is sleeping constantly, you have got to think infection, pneumonia, UTI, sepsis, rule those out first. It's like their body tries to conserve energy by masking the usual signs like fever and pain.
Okay, and if we're doing a hands-on physical exam, besides the mental status, what are we looking and listening for?
You'll definitely see signs of the body under stress. Tachycardia, fast heart rate, increased work of breathing tachypnea, shallow rapid breaths. You'll check the pulse ox, look for hypoxemia, low oxygen sats. When you listen with your stethoscope, you're listening for crackles, that sound of air bubbling through fluid in the alveoli, or maybe wheezing. In really bad cases, you might see them using accessory muscles, neck muscles, shoulder muscles trying to pull air in, or nasal flaring. And always look at the sputum. How much, what color, any odor. It gives you instant clues about what kind of infection might be going on.
Let's shift to the diagnostic toolkit. For students, I think understanding the order of things is really important, especially around antibiotics.
The sequence is critical, absolutely. It always starts with your history and physical exam. That leads you to what objective data you need. And usually the first piece of objective evidence we get is imaging.
The chest X-ray.
Yep. The chest X-ray is still the workhorse. It lets us see the consolidation, that white opaque area showing the fluid buildup, and figure out how widespread the pneumonia is. Sometimes, if it's really complex or we're worried about complications like an abscess or fluid around the lung, a CT scan might be needed for more detailed pictures.
And the step that's most time sensitive, the one that really shapes the whole treatment plan.
Cultures. Absolutely critical. You have to get sputum cultures and blood cultures before you give that first dose of antibiotics. Cannot stress that enough. Why? Because if you give antibiotics first, you can kill off or suppress the bacteria just enough that the cultures come back negative. Even if the patient does have a bacterial infection, a false negative, then you're stuck guessing, maybe using broad antibiotics that aren't quite right while the infection might still be smoldering. And when you get that sputum sample, make sure it's really sputum from deep down, not just spit. Coach the patient to take a deep breath and give a good, strong cough into the sterile cup. Now, a positive sputum culture is helpful, tells you what bug is likely in the lungs, but a positive blood culture, that's much more serious. That means bacteremia, the infection has escaped the lungs and is now in the bloodstream. That patient is on the fast track towards sepsis.
Okay, looking at the blood work itself, what labs tell us, yeah, this looks like a classic bacterial fight?
The CBC complete blood count with differential, that's your go-to. A high white blood cell count, especially with lots of neutrophils, that strongly suggests bacteria are involved. If the white count is normal, or maybe the lymphocytes are high instead, that might point more towards a virus. We also often look at inflammatory markers like C-reactive protein, CRP, or procalcitonin, PCT. PCT is interesting because it tends to go up more specifically with bacterial infections, especially sepsis. It can actually help doctors decide whether to start antibiotics or maybe when it's safe to stop them.
And finally, measuring the failure itself, how well are the lungs actually doing their job of oxygenating?
That's where the arterial blood gas, the ABG, comes in. It's the gold standard. It directly measures the oxygen level, the carbon dioxide level, and the pH in the arterial blood. It gives you a real-time snapshot of respiratory function. It's crucial for seeing how bad that VQ mismatch really is. If the patient is starting to retain CO2, or if their blood pH is dropping, becoming acidotic, that's a sign they're heading towards respiratory failure. Might need intubation urgently. And don't forget specific rapid tests, like there's a urine antigen test for Legionella. That's important if there's an outbreak potentially linked to a water source, like air conditioning systems. And of course, rapid tests for flu and COVID-19. Crucial, because a positive viral test means you can usually hold off on antibiotics and focus on supportive care.
Okay, section four, prevention and the active nursing management.
Right. And connecting this back, the difference between a good outcome and, well, a bad one often comes down to how good the nursing prevention is, especially in the hospital. A lot of hospital-acquired pneumonia is potentially preventable. This is where you, as students learning this now, can have a massive impact.
Let's start broad. Public health stuff. Things done even before someone gets sick enough for the hospital. Vaccinations.
Prevention definitely starts way upstream. We've got the pneumococcal vaccines, PCD13 and PPSV23. They target the most common bacterial causes like strep pneumo, strongly recommended for everyone 65 and older, and also for younger people with chronic conditions, heart disease, lung disease, liver problems, diabetes, weakened immune systems. And just as vital, the annual flu shot, influenza. The flu virus itself makes you pretty sick, sure. But its biggest danger often lies in paving the way for a secondary bacterial pneumonia to set in while your defenses are down. So preventing the flu is a super effective way to prevent a lot of serious pneumonia cases.
And the absolute bedrock of safety for every single patient interaction.
Hand hygiene. Sounds basic, right?
Like,
but perfect hand washing or using alcohol-based rub before and after you touch every patient every time. It's the single most powerful weapon against spreading germs, especially those nasty resistant hospital bugs that cause HAP and VAP.
Okay, now let's really zero in on those prevention protocols that students have to know inside out. The things that get audited, that are core to quality care. The VAP and aspiration prevention protocols.
Right, the VAP prevention bundle. This isn't optional. It's a set of proven, evidence-based actions that nurses do to tackle the main drivers of ventilator-associated pneumonia. Mastering this bundle, that shows you're ready for critical care.
First, just simple physics, using gravity.
Positioning, absolutely key. Keep the head of the bed, HOB, elevated, at least 30 degrees, preferably more like 30 to 45. Why? Gravity helps stop stomach contents from refluxing up and getting into the lungs. It also helps oral secretions, which tend to pool above the cuff of the breathing tube, from trickling down. Unless there's a specific medical reason not to, like a spinal injury, that head needs to be up, and you document if it can't be.
Next, getting the patient off the ventilator sooner rather than later.
Exactly. That's the daily sedation vacation or sedation interruption. Nurses, working with respiratory therapists and doctors, periodically lighten or turn off sedation. Let the patient wake up a bit. This lets you check their neurostatus, but crucially, it lets you assess if they might be ready to breathe on their own, ready for extubation. The less time spent on that vent, drastically lower risk of VAP. Knowing how and when to do this safely is a core critical care skill.
And the mouth? Big source of bacteria. How do we deal with that?
Meticulous, regular oral care. And it has to include using chlorhexidine solution. Chlorhexidine is an antiseptic. It significantly cuts down the amount of bacteria in the mouth and throat. And this isn't just a quick toothbrush swipe. It's a thorough cleaning teeth, gums, tongue, oral mucosa. You're trying to break down the biofilm where those resistant bugs like to hide and multiply, usually done every few hours.
We also need to keep the lungs open and clear out secretions, right?
Definitely. For patients who can participate, even if intubated, using an incentive spirometer helps encourage those deep breaths. Fights off atelectasis, collapsed alveoli, which are perfect breeding grounds for infection. For the intubated patient, regular sterile suctioning is vital. You have to clear out the secretions that build up above the tube cuff and also deeper down in the airways. Stop them from sliding down into the lungs.
And sometimes managing the stomach helps protect the lungs.
Yeah, indirectly. We often use medicines like PPIs, proton pump inhibitors, or H2 blockers. They reduce stomach acid production. The thinking is, if the patient does reflux or aspirate, which we're trying hard to prevent the material going into the lungs, will be less acidic. Less acid means less severe chemical injury, that initial pneumonitis, which might make a subsequent bacterial infection less likely or less severe.
Okay, shifting to general aspiration prevention. For patients who aren't intubated, but we know they have trouble swallowing.
These are basic rules, but they have huge implications if missed. Rule number one. Never, ever feed a patient orally if you haven't confirmed they can protect their airway. Check that gag reflex. Check their level of alertness. And follow the speech therapist's diet recommendations to the letter, thickened liquids, pureed food, whatever they've ordered. If the patient has a feeding tube, you have to be meticulous about checking placement. Before you start any feed, confirm that tube is in the right spot. Usually check residuals, maybe listen for air insufflation, or confirm with an x-ray if it's newly placed, depending on your hospital's policy. A tube that slipped out of the stomach and into the esophagus is a direct rate for aspiration. And if you're feeding someone, tube or oral, and they suddenly start coughing, choking, look short of breath, or their O2 sats drop, stop the feed immediately. Assess what's going on.
All right, so pneumonia is diagnosed. What's the core of the medical and supportive management that nurses are involved in?
Okay. If it's bacterial, the absolute cornerstone is starting the right antibiotic, targeted therapy. But like we said, cultures take time, right? 48, 72 hours sometimes. So we start empirically, meaning we give broad spectrum antibiotics based on whether we think it's CAP, HAP, risk factors, etc. Educated guess, basically. Then once those culture results come back with the specific bug and what it's sensitive to, we narrow the treatment down, use the most specific, narrowest spectrum drug that will work. That's antibiotic stewardship. How long? It varies. Uncomplicated CAP might only need 5 days, HAP or VAP, often much longer, maybe 7 to 14 days or more. And if it's viral, no antibiotics, unless there's a secondary bacterial infection suspected. Management is all supportive care.
And the nursing role in that supportive care sounds really comprehensive. Mobilizing secretions, optimizing oxygen.
It really is. We push hydration fluids, help thin out those thick, sticky secretions, making them easier to cough up. But caution here, especially in the elderly or heart failure patients. Gotta watch carefully for fluid overload. We make sure they get enough nutrition. Sometimes they need supplements or help from dietary. And rest is crucial. Just breathing when you have pneumonia is hard work. Exhausting.
Can you talk about the specific nursing actions that help clear the airways?
Sure. We're constantly encouraging them to cough effectively, take deep breaths, use that incentive spirometer. If it's ordered, we might do chest physiotherapy, CPT. That involves percussion, rhythmically clapping on the chest wall over the affected areas and vibration. It physically helps loosen secretions stuck deep down. CPT is oftentimes strategically, like maybe after they've had a nebulizer treatment, which can also help loosen things up, and usually before meals, so they don't get nauseous or aspirate. We monitor their oxygen saturation continuously with pulse oximetry, give supplemental oxygen as needed to keep their SATs up, usually above 90 or 92%, depending on the order, and critically important, early mobilization, get them moving, ambulation. We want to avoid bed rest as much as possible. Lying flat just lets secretions pool in the dependent parts of the lungs, promotes atelectasis, makes everything worse. Even just getting the patient up to sit in a chair, take a short walk down the hall, helps tremendously with aerating the lungs, especially the bases.
What about just making them comfortable and getting them ready to go home?
Comfort's huge. We give meds as ordered. Antipyretics like acetaminophen or ibuprofen for fever, bringing down fever reduces the body's metabolic demands. Maybe antitussives, cough suppressants, usually only if the cough is really dry, hacking and exhausting, not productive. We don't want to suppress a cough that's actually clearing stuff out. Sometimes decongestants or antihistamines if there's a lot of upper airway congestion too. And before discharge, patient education is paramount. Two main things. One, they must finish the entire course of antibiotics, even if they start feeling better after a few days, stopping early breeds resistance. Two, make sure they understand about follow-up and about getting needed vaccinations in the future, especially that annual flu shot, and making sure their pneumococcal vaccines are up to date.
Okay, section 5, complications and some special considerations. So what happens if the treatment isn't quite working or the patient was really sick to begin with? We need to know those red flags, the signs that things are going south fast.
Vigilance. That's the nurse's superpower here. You're constantly watching for the big, scary complications. The two most immediate threats are probably acute respiratory failure, where the lungs just can't keep up anymore, which needs rapid escalation, often ventilation, and sepsis or septic shock.
Let's focus on respiratory failure first. What are the subtle signs, maybe before the O2 sats plummet, that a student should pick up on?
Yeah, don't just watch the monitor, watch the patient. Look at their work of breathing. Are they getting more anxious, restless? Are they using those neck muscles, accessory muscles, to breathe? Is their breathing becoming paradoxical? Chest goes in when the belly goes out. That's a sign of severe muscle fatigue. Can they speak in full sentences, or are they gasping after just one or two words? These are all signs that their respiratory muscles are tiring out. Failure could be imminent. You need to call for help fast. And sepsis, same thing, gotta catch it early. Pneumonia is a super common starting point for sepsis. The infection triggers this out-of-control body-wide inflammation. Blood vessels dilate, blood pressure drops, organs start to fail. So look for those rapid changes. Sudden confusion again, persistent low blood pressure even after giving fluids, high fever combined with that fast heart rate and fast breathing. That cluster of signs should scream sepsis.
And besides the whole system failing, what about problems localized right there in the chest?
Right, local complications. We monitor for these, often with follow-up x-rays or CT scans. Pleural effusion is common. That's just extra fluid building up in the pleural space, the area between the lung and the chest wall. But if that fluid gets infected, that's empyema, basically pus collecting in that pleural space. Empyema is serious business. It usually needs a chest tube put in to drain all that thick, infected gunk out, sometimes even surgery, plus long courses of antibiotics. We also watch for lung abscesses, pockets of infection and dead tissue that get walled off inside the lung itself.
Yeah, and those systemic or maybe rarer complications, especially thinking about the elderly or immunocompromised patients we talked about.
Yeah, in the elderly, that initial confusion can worsen into really profound delirium if the infection isn't controlled. And sometimes, though less common, the bacteria can spread widely through the blood, that bacteremia we mentioned. And from there, it can seed infections elsewhere, cause pericarditis, inflammation around the heart, endocarditis, infection on the heart valves, even meningitis, infection of the lining around the brain and spinal cord. It just highlights why continuous head-to-toe reassessment is so crucial. Catching these complications early makes a huge difference.
Okay, and finally, just a quick touch on the modern context. COVID-19 considerations. That really gave everyone a crash course in severe viral pneumonia, didn't it?
It absolutely did. SARS-CoV-2 really drove home how devastating a primary viral pneumonia can be. Diagnosis needs those specific tests, PCR, antigen tests. And crucially, because it's viral, it reinforced that basic principle. Antibiotics are only for suspected secondary bacterial infections. Otherwise, treatment is all supportive.
And the difference in how that supportive care looked for severe COVID versus mild.
Right. Mild cases were the usual rest, fluids, fever reducers at home, but severe COVID pneumonia, that required massive respiratory support, high-flow oxygen, non-invasive ventilation like BiPAP or CPAP, and if that wasn't enough, mechanical ventilation. A key strategy that really came to the forefront was prone positioning. Flipping the intubated patient onto their stomach, it sounds simple, but it dramatically improves oxygenation in many patients by helping recruit or open up parts of the lungs in the back that were collapsed or poorly ventilated when lying flat.
And there was that specific antiviral mentioned for severe cases.
Yeah, remdesivir, an antiviral drug given IV. The idea was to interfere with the virus's ability to replicate. It was used alongside all the supportive care, trying to manage that intense inflammatory storm the virus often triggered. It just underscores that even with new viruses, the fundamental nursing care managing oxygenation, supporting breathing, preventing complications remains absolutely core. Okay, so wrapping up this deep dive, let's really crystallize those main nursing responsibilities, the things you as students need to walk away knowing and ready to apply. First, master assessment. That means not just knowing the classic signs, but being hyper aware of those atypical presentations. The confusion, the weakness in older adults. Trusting your gut even if the thermometer reads normal. Second, prevention protocols.
Yeah.
Meticulous, obsessive application of the VAP bundle, the aspiration precautions. These aren't just tasks on a checklist, they are fundamental patient safety actions, non-negotiable. And third, vigilant monitoring, constantly watching for those early signs of decline, those shifts towards respiratory failure, sepsis, emphysema, catching complications early. Those three areas, sharp assessment, relentless prevention, and vigilant monitoring, that's where nursing makes the biggest difference in pneumonia outcomes.
Yeah, and to make this really concrete for you listeners, the sources strongly suggest connecting this knowledge directly to your skills, labs, and clinicals. If your program has labs on tract care, suctioning techniques, managing chest tubes, go to them with the VAP bundle fresh in your mind. See how it applies. And actively look up your hospital-specific protocols for HAP prevention when you get to clinicals. This isn't just theory. It's the stuff you'll be doing day in, day out, which, you know, it raises a bigger question for me. We know HAP and VAP are still pretty common, right?
Mm.
And we know a lot of it's preventable. It feels like a system failure sometimes. So beyond just us individually following the rule, what bigger changes might be needed? Things like hospital staffing levels, maybe different technologies, maybe just a whole culture around safety. What could really drive down the risk of these infections systemically? And thinking longer term as you become nurses, how could your voice, your practice, your advocacy actually contribute to making those bigger systemic changes happen?
That's a really powerful thought to end on. We absolutely need nurses who don't just follow the protocols, but who constantly ask why they're needed and who fight for the resources and the environment to execute them perfectly. Every single time.
Stay vigilant, everyone. Stay curious. And never underestimate the impact of your preventative care. We'll catch you on the next deep dive.